Hi everybody, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll, welcoming you to the weekly podcast from the Banter team. There was a full house in attendance for our very last Banter event at the Twisted Pepper in Mid-Labby Street before it closed. This saw us talk about the future of food shopping and supermarkets with panellists Henry Dummer, Director of Marketing at Tesco, Rachel Firth, General Manager at Fallon & Byrne, Joe Doyle, the founder of Donnybrook Fair, and Norman Rides, the General Manager at the Dublin Food Co-op. They joined us to talk at great length about what they see coming down the line about how we buy food. Hi everybody, welcome along to Banter number 109. My name is Jim Carroll. Thank you all so much for coming out. We have a full house tonight, which shows the kind of interest in this topic. When we start talking about this topic in the first place, the future of food shopping and the future of supermarkets, basically it's a kind of, this is a bit of a steal, because it was an idea which is influenced by a guy called Phil Lemper. None of you here probably heard of Phil Lemper. Phil Lemper is the self-styled supermarket guru. And I don't think maybe someone here on the panel will be the self-styled supermarket guru at the end of tonight, but we'll wait and see what happens. And Phil Lemper spoke at Cyber West last in March about trends in the food retail business, and he had various interesting observations to make about what's to come. But an awful lot of the observations he had to make were really kind of geared to the American market, and it got me thinking about, what exactly is ahead for the food retail business in Ireland? Will be coming down the road in terms of supermarkets, in terms of people selling food in the future? So I put this panel together. I'd like to introduce each one of the people. At the very end of the table, we have Rachel Firth from Fallon & Byrne. She's a general manager at Fallon & Byrne. Next to her, we have Norman Rides. He's a general manager of the Dublin Food Co-op. Next to him, we have Joe Doyle, who's the founder of Donnybrook Fair. And last but by no means least, we have Henry Dummer, who's the director of marketing at Tesco Ireland. Please give them a warm round of applause. So just a little bit of housekeeping before we get going. We'll have a discussion here for about 45 minutes or so. Then there'll be a short break so you can kind of gather your thoughts and kind of go to the supermarket and avail of a 2-for-1 offer down the road. And then we'll have some questions from the floor. So if you have any questions, please hold them for the latter part of the discussion. Let's start, Rachel. How long have you been at Fallon & Byrne, and what were you doing before that?
I've been with Fallon & Byrne since it was an idea at Fiona and Paul's kitchen table. So we opened in 2006. I joined them about 6 months previously. And before that, I studied history in Trinity, and then I went to work for Sheridan's Cheesemongers. So I was, involved
in
cheese.
Perfect. Okay, Norman, in terms of the Dublin Food Co-op, it's been going since 1983. Tell us a little bit about it and its business model, how many customers it has at the moment.
We don't have customers, we have members, because you actually have to join to be part of the co-op. We've been going 32 years, we've got 1,800 members at the moment. In that time, it's quite an interesting model, because in the UK, 20 years ago, I was setting up a credit union in Southampton, and all the local people were saying, "Well, so you want me to give you my money, and you're not a bank? How does that work then?" And then the moment we opened, there was a queue of Irish and West Indians around the block. They got the credit union idea. In the UK, consumer cooperation is much bigger. 10 billion for the co-op group, 8 million members, much more part of the culture. Every MP tells a story of having their mother's divvy number. And I come to Ireland, and there's only a handful of consumer co-ops, and we're one of the biggest. And it's a quite different model, so we're trying to change the way people shop in Ireland.
How many co-ops are in the country, Norman? Roughly.
Consumer co-ops, there's very few pure consumer co-ops. The main one is up in Donegal, and that was set up by a famous individual called Paddy the Co-op about 100 years ago. Other than that, a lot of the agricultural co-ops deal in consumer goods, but that's a sideline to the agricultural cooperative main business. So there's very few organisations like us which are purely consumer driven.
Okay, excellent. Okay, and Joe, initially when you opened Donnybrook Fair, I was reading last week that your plan was to have a food hall in Dublin 4. You've come a long way since that.
Well, I suppose life takes you on the journey. You keep going the best you can. I suppose Donnybrook Fair is probably, it's going longer than I am, the actual brand name, but we took it over about 20 years ago. and we remodeled it. I think it's 12 years, coming 13 now at this stage. And we just saw a niche in the market, and we've kind of followed it. And it's a journey we hope to keep going for a while.
Right. How many stores do you have at the moment? How many are on the plans?
We have 5 at the moment. We hope to have another one by the end of the year, so we do.
Okay, excellent. Okay. And then, Henry, in terms of Tesco, there may be some older people in the audience like myself who remember Tesco before Tesco was in existence in Quinsworth, and you've been in Ireland since 1997, you know. Tell me a little bit, first of all, a bit about yourself, and then, let's talk a little bit about Tesco and Tesco's kind of plans in Ireland. What were you doing before Tesco?
Okay, I came over in 2006, so I feel like I've earned my stripes, because I came in sort of the height of the Celtic Tiger, and I've sort of seen it all the way through. I worked at Diageo, the drinks company, so for those that don't know, Guinness, Budweiser, Carlsberg, Smirnoff, worked there for 5 years, and then joined Tesco in 2011. So I've sort of been on the bumpy ride of Tesco for the last 3.5 years. Mm.
I mean, like thinking about Tesco, when the shops of Quinns were, they were very much kind of supermarkets in the old school sense. And Tesco has definitely evolved. You've got various models. You've got the Tesco, what's called the Tesco Express shops, and then you've got the bigger kind of hypermarket shops. Yeah. You know, I mean, in terms of the future, I mean, can you see, this is the first future question of the evening. I mean, can you see basically Tesco, I suppose, consolidating on that kind of score, or will there be more expansion? If there is more expansion, will there be different kind of models come to the fore, do you think?
Well, okay. I think that the big trend for us in terms of formats is online. Huge growth in online. I look forward to talking about that as we go through the evening. I think the extra format, I don't think we will be rolling out more extras. I think because of the growth of online, I don't think there's the need for that big, consolidated, all-in-one shop experience. So I don't think we'll be doing more of those. I mean, I'd never say never, but I don't think so. Whereas if I look at the last couple of years where we have expanded stores, it has been in the smaller supermarket and the convenience format, sort of closer to where people live and work, and they're proving to be very successful. So I think the future lies in smaller format, and then I think a sort of integrated development of on and offline together.
The Fallon and Burn experience, Rachel, it's best known kind of as a high-end food shop. I mean, you opened in 2006, so, I mean, you're nearly 10 years in business now. Have you, kind of as someone who's, on the shop floor, who's noticing trends on the shop floor, have you noticed kind of a change in the consumer? Have you, as a consumer, got more savvy? Is a consumer looking for, different kinds of goods than they were maybe, 10 years ago? And what do you think is driving that?
I think when we opened, we very much wanted to be a specialist food store. So, we don't sell nappies and shampoo and some of the basic products. So it's very much a specialist food store. I think when we first opened in 2006, it was, as you just said, it was the boom. And we had people going around with trolleys, filling them with all kinds of luxury items. On Saturdays, it was it was quite a spectacle. That obviously died off when things calmed down. But we are still very much a specialist food store. So it's changed in the size of the trolleys, has changed, and it's now very much basket shopping. But people come to us for their specialist products, whether it be artisan cheeses or, specific products that we would import from all over Europe. So I think the way people are shopping has changed quite a lot. And we would get people who shop with us maybe 3 times a day. I mean, they might come in for a coffee, then grab a sandwich, and then come back again the evening to get something for dinner. So it's, I think where we are in Dublin too, it's a different kind of supermarket experience, I suppose.
Mm. I mean, from the Donnybrook Fair viewpoint, then, Joe, I mean, would a lot of what Rachel says chime with you in terms of how people shop? Or is there still an element of people coming to Donnybrook Fair to do the big shop?
Well, I suppose there's a mixture of customer, really, I suppose. During the weekdays, you would have people shopping for the day or for shop for that night or whatever. But weekends, we would have a lot of basket shop or trolley shop as well happening in the main stores. So it would, we've kind of two different formats. But the main would be Saystallorgan and Moorhampton Road would be still a lot of weekly shopping. So there's, but there again, it'd be more for the high, for the fresh food end of it more so than the the commercial grocery end, if you like to call it that.
I didn't normally mean from the co-op point of view then. Like, I mean, have you kind of like noticed that like your members are looking for different things? I mean, has the range of goods that you're selling and trading, and has that changed in the last couple of years? Like, have you noticed that?
Well, very much so. In the last couple of years, we've reintroduced chilled goods, which we didn't do for a long time, but member demand said we want chilled goods. So we provide them. We also provide frozen goods, which we'd never done before. Moving into more non-foods, environmentally friendly products, sort of environmentally friendly nappies, toilet rolls, kitchen rolls, those sorts of things. Cleaning products, very much so. We're looking at the moment at sustainable palm oil, sort of not plantation palm oil from Malaysia, but sustainable palm oil from West Africa. So, yeah, there's, tastes change and evolve. And what we found particularly interesting in the last couple of years is the number of newcomers to Ireland who are coming to us. I would say about a third of our new members are EU non-Irish. So we've got Poles, Italians, Lithuanians, Spanish, French. You know, they seem to come to Dublin and they say, okay, where am I going to do my shopping? Oh, the food co-op. That's the sort of place that I'm used to back home, which is, I think, an interesting trend.
Like, I already asked Henry this question. So there are three panelists. You know, in terms of your business model in your shop, Stonybrook Fair, the food co-op, and like Fanlon Burn, 5 years from now, do you expect many changes? I mean, it's a general question to start off. Do you expect many changes in how you operate in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think something that you were just saying, I mean, tastes change. So obviously, the product offering is always going to keep changing and keep evolving, and you know, the things that people want. And the things that are important to people, I think, as well, you know, now when people spend money, they want to be, you know, they're spending it with a conscience, but they're also, they want to know where it comes from and who's making it. And, you know, all of these things are really important. I think the whole tech world is evolving so rapidly for all of us. I think for smaller businesses, it's you have to decide when to sort of go on board. I mean, I'm sure there's, you know, massive departments in Tesco figuring it all out. But I think for, you know, it's going to affect all of us. And I know as a consumer myself, I always have my smartphone with a shopping list. And, you know, so it's how we use that technology, I think, is going to be a massive thing for all of us.
I mean, just Fanlon Burn at the moment, do you take in much data? Is there data capturing being done at the tills? Or is it, I don't think there is there? Okay, is it something you've talked about doing?
Yes, but again, it's, you know, it's a small business and it's, you know, it's a huge investment, so it's deciding when to do it. And technology is changing so rapidly as well. It is in our plan, and it will happen within the next 12 months, I'd imagine. But it's, even from about starting talking about 3 years ago, everything has changed so quickly that it's, you know, you have to keep, decide when to make the investment and then sort of make the right choice. Yeah.
I saw you smiling there, Norman, when I started talking about capturing data. Is capturing data something that it matters at the food co-op? I imagine it does, because, I mean, if you're talking about 1,800 members, you need to know what they want.
Well, yes. Our basic business model is find out what the members want and deliver it. But data capture is an issue with a lot of our members, because 30 years ago when we started, there wasn't organic food. A lot of our founder members were involved with the Carnsaw Point anti-nuclear movement. They've been involved in anti-GMO. We're active in the water protest. They're active in the Yes Equality campaign. And a lot of them are very, very sensitive about who's got what information on them for very good reasons. So if I said, you know, I'm going to introduce a system to capture data the way large supermarkets do, I don't think I'd be live tomorrow morning.
In terms of, like, I mean, of the first part of the question, Norm, in terms of like the business model, in terms of where you see the food co-op being in 5 years' time, can you envisage many changes coming?
Yes, I mean, the changes are coming, because the members are changing and they're moving with it. I mean, what's interesting is getting the balance between what is going to be permanent and what is going to be open to change. I think we're a vegetarian organisation, although interestingly, two-thirds of our members eat meat. Yet two-thirds of our members want to keep the vegetarian ethos, which means that 50% of our meat eaters support the vegetarian ethos of the co-op. So that's an interesting one. But
there's data. I mean, like, you know, that's data, you know?
Oh, absolutely. But it's not individual data. That's from our surveys. And people can answer the surveys how they want.
Right.
But yes, I mean, we're going to be looking at online supplying of bulk orders, but I don't think we'll be doing delivery because the co-op is an experience. It's a place you go to for the buzz and the vibe. It's not a walk in, do your shopping and walk out sort of experience. It's much more of a community. But yes, there'll be a lot of changes. We need to discuss them with members and make sure we're up to date with what the competition are doing. Mm.
Joe, like what do you see kind of like Donnybrook Fair being in? What kind of, I suppose, what will the model look like 5 years from now?
Well, I suppose we're like everybody else. We're looking at caption data all the time, and online is something that we're involved in at the moment. I suppose we're just dipping our toe in the water a little bit, we're doing a lot of online catering, you know, private catering, so we're using that. Yeah, and last Christmas we've done quite a lot with hampers and that type of thing, but it's like everything else, is putting your finances and the investment into them. So at the moment, we'd hope within the next 12 months that we'll have a full online system going. So we have, it probably won't be full-blown, it'll be very specialist, maybe starting off the catering, getting that right, wines, different, you know, that type of thing. Where's it going to be from now? We're very much a fresh food store, more so than, you know, the general grocery store. So it's evolving all the time. You know, healthy eating, people are looking for more and more, you know, trends towards that. So we're doing a lot of work on that at the moment. So we are.
Cool. Okay. So, just before we kind of move on to this series of nutrition and kind of health, I mean, I want to kind of stick with the data question and come to you, Henry, about that. You know, is there a number of data scientists employed at Tesco to kind of like, I mean, analyze the data that's coming through on those club cards? You know, I mean, is it very clear to use? Like, I mean, can you kind of see it? I mean, like, Patrick Frayne had a very interesting article in the Irish Times during the week about Paddy Power and how they manage their kind of data. So I'm kind of envisioning, are there similar data nerds at Tesco analyzing every time we buy nappies, or we buy bread, we buy milk or whatever?
Yeah, we're kind of good for nerds. We've got plenty of good data nerds, and they're great, actually. It is one of the most sort of fascinating parts of my role, is looking at the data that we capture through Clubcard is incredibly revealing in terms of macro trends as well as individual choices. And so, yeah, to have the kind of data analyst that can turn that into useful information, I think it's interesting, because I think there is a skepticism around, you know, how might a company like Tesco use data. And I think one of the interesting challenges that we have is how do we stay relevant to an individual? When you're big and you've got big stores, the danger is you become kind of homogenous and it's one size fits all. And actually what the data allows us to do, if we get it right, is it allows us to make sure that our propositions can be tailored to individuals. I mean, a small example would be in online shopping. You know, once a customer's done one shop, then all of their favorites are then held for them to then kind of continue and use. And other things that when we send information to customers, and a good example of what we used to do, we used to let's say a supplier like Coke came to us. They would typically say, you know, I want to win Pepsi customers, so they would send direct marketing material to people who bought Pepsi. And we, about 2 years ago, kind of had a bit of a revelation that this was irritating customers. This was irritating customers because they don't buy Pepsi. So why are you sending me stuff on Pepsi? And we flipped it and we said, from now on, we will only send information on Coke to people who like and enjoy and regularly buy Coke. And that was a real challenge for the supply base, because that prevents them kind of acquiring new customers potentially. But what it allows us to do is therefore be more relevant to our customers. So I'm a huge fan of data, and it's fascinating.
Mm. I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, you talked there about, like, I mean, I suppose the micro use of data, but macro use as well. I mean, it does have macro use, because, I mean, your boss, Dave Lewis, was kind of saying that they were noticing in the first quarter this year that the biggest growth area was coming in those kind of big shops, those kind of like hypermarkets. Like, and that kind of like brings me on to the next question about, like, you know, that where are we going to see in the future? Are we going to see a return to kind of smaller shops? Or is it a case of, like, I mean, your big shops, your big kind of out-of-town stores is where people are going to go? Because when they go there, they can buy clothes, they can buy hardware goods, they can buy Pete Briquettes. Like, you know, like, I mean, you know, there's all, like, all your shops in the UK have kind of expanded as well. They've now got Giraffe Restaurant inside them. They've also got, like, I mean, the really nice bakery and the coffee shop as well. Is that a trend you can kind of see happening here in Ireland as well? That, like, I mean, those one-size-fits-all shops shops are growing, and that's what people want at the moment.
Well, the two ends of our business are the strength ends. So the extras, as we call them, the big formats where you get all the additional services, opticians, pharmacy, post office, etc. They're doing very well. And for a certain cohort of customers, typically big families, they really meet their needs because they can, you know, do effectively an awful lot in one place. And then the other end of the spectrum is the small stores are also doing well. The challenge for us actually is in the middle ground and making sure that they evolve in the right way. And I think the interesting thing on online, just to come back to it, it is an enormous growth area for us. I mean, to put it into perspective, it's in about 40% growth. And we reach about 86% of the population with our online offer. It's in huge growth, but what's really interesting is it's still only 3% of our sales, which is fascinating. You know, we consider we're probably one of the more developed players in online. But it's still a tiny proportion of our sales, and we get very excited about online. It's very innovative. It's very, and we have to remind ourselves that 97% of our sales are still coming through, you know, the stores. So
is that something the rest of you've noticed as well? I mean, like, you know, I mean, I don't know about anyone in the audience, but I've never ordered a food from a store online. You know, I prefer the experience of going in. Have you, like, I mean, each, like, I mean, like Joe with Tony Brook Fair, the food co-op, Fallon Bourne, is there, like, I mean, is it still the kind of like the experience that people want to have, the experience of going into the shop? I mean, have you noticed any sort of demand for online? Is this something we're going to go to in the future? Because, I mean, there's an elephant in the room when it comes to, I suppose, food shopping as well. And that is, like, I mean, if Amazon decided to set up, I mean, they're going to beat everyone on price anyway, you know.
Yeah, I think it's true. But the thing that Amazon won't be able to do is they won't be able to choose your tomatoes that are really ripe or that particular, those steaks cut exactly the way you want them cut. And I think it's fresh food that online will never be able to touch. And I think, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but the biggest growth in online is all of the other stuff that you don't particularly want to lug around, which is, you know, the washing up powder and the nappies again and whatever, all those big clunky things. So I think there's always going to be that, you know, that those specialist products that people want to touch and feel. And, you know, food is a sensory thing. So it's a lot, you know, we all have to eat. And if you enjoy eating and if you enjoy food, you're going to want to touch and feel what you buy and have a chat with the butcher and, you know, or in the market with the grower, whoever grew those vegetables or whoever it is. And there's always going to be that element of it. And I think there's two sides that are, you know, there's two very different sides to the whole food business.
And Joe, you mentioned earlier on about ramping up your online business. Is that something that Donnybrook Fair customers are looking for?
Well, I think where we see it, it lets people, it's a window to let people know what we have in store and everything else as well. So it's a kind of a two-edged sword, we feel like, I mean. Mm. So it's communicating what we do. Will it take over a huge part of our business? We don't suspect it will, but I think it's something, it's trendy, so it has to be there, I think.
Okay. Let's turn to kind of, like, I mean, I suppose one other issue that I don't think is going to go away. I think even 10 years from now, if we have a panel like this, it'll still come up. And that's price, you know? I mean, obviously Tesco had competition coming in from kind of Lidl and from Aldi, from the Germans are here selling cheap salami and cheese. So that's competition. Even in terms of Fallon and Bourne, I mean, there's competition because it's like, I mean, like, you know, your kind of fruit and veg have to be very competitive because you've got Dunnes across the road from you, you know? I'm sure it's the same with Donnybrook Fair and Dublin Food Co-op. Is price still the main thing people are going for, or are you kind of finding that some customers are kind of, I suppose, putting other things top of the priority list?
I think it's one of the things that's important to people, but I think there's a number of things, and you know, where the product comes from, who made the product, the integrity of whoever made it, the taste of it is right up there at number one always. You know, for us, we taste everything that goes onto our shelves, but price is really important, and especially in, you know, the last few years, everyone's been pretty tight, so you are going to compare, and obviously Aldi and Lidl have come in here and done an astounding job of offering, you know, amazing value, but it's for a certain type of product. So again, I think the future of shopping is, I think people aren't very loyal and people will pick and choose between different supermarkets and different shopping experiences as well, so I think there's kind of room out there for everything, because people go to where offers are, I think, a lot at the moment is the reality.
Well, when we started off, we were very much a buying group with, basically, you'd buy a bunch of products, you'd divide the cost by how much everybody bought, it would be sold at cost price plus a couple of percent, and we moved quite a long way from that model. So we're going in the opposite direction to everybody else, if you like. But I think there's going to be a split between basic functional retailing and value-added retailing. And I think, you know, use the example of Amazon. You still have bookshops, you still have Hughes and Figgis, is it? Hodges and Figgis.
There's no point, Norman, having bookshops. You can't remember the name of them.
Yeah. I just know it's a place I like to go to, so that's all I need to know. I think there is going to be that that split. In terms of supermarkets, you can go in and you can talk to a human being, or you can be served by a robot who says, unexpected item in bagging area. It's a bag. What's unexpected about a bag in the bagging area?
Well done, Norman. You've actually used my punchline for the very last line, you know? Thanks a million for that. Have you noticed kind of like me and Donnybrook Fair customers, I suppose, reacting in terms of price, Joe?
Of course, everybody is out there looking for a bargain and looking but I say it's value for money. It's the quality of what you're selling against the price you're charging. And I suppose, so similar to Fallon Byrne, we're earning on the price of quality, number one, first of all. I suppose, you know, anything we sell, even our already meals or whatever, they're no more than 48 hours, you know, produced at the very max, most of them 24 hours before the consumer consumes them. So it's a different, you know, so it's value for money, as I keep saying, you know, mm. Ian, and that's, so it's what you're giving the customer. Mm. That's very important, so it is. You know. Mm.
I mean, do you reckon as well, Henry, that price will still be one of the things in the future that, like, I mean, Tesco will be using to try and differentiate itself from its competitors?
I think price is the most important for our sector of the industry. But I agree with Joe completely. It's not price as in cheap. It's price without compromise, so it's value. And I think where I admire Aldi and Lidl is that I think they have been very successful at not compromising quality. I think the integrity of the product, by and large, is there. So hence why they're such a formidable competitor for me, because it isn't cheap with compromise. And I don't think the Irish consumer would, even in the recession, would make that trade-off. But I think it is about value for money. So this is a good thing for the consumer, because I think it forces all of us to therefore kind of really raise our game in response.
Yeah, and then, like, I mean, in order for you to kind of, like, I mean, sell the goods at good prices and good value, I mean, you need to kind of, like, I suppose, play tough with the suppliers as well, you know? I mean, is that something that's kind of going to be continuing in the future? You know, the way you deal with suppliers, and the deals you're going to try and get from them, I mean, is there ever going to come a situation where there's going to be an easier relationship between the two of you?
This is a funny one, you know. I think we negotiate hard. And I think the buyers in the buying teams are briefed to, you know, fight hard for the right deal. I think one of the conversations that we are having now is, you know, it's very important to not allow the negotiating hard to go past the line. And I think particularly when you're big and you're dealing with a supplier who may be small, the balance of power isn't even. And therefore, we have to sort of wield that relationship quite carefully and responsibly. And I think there's never been more attention to that balance of power and making sure that we don't allow our enthusiasm to negotiate hard to trip over a line that therefore starts to feel that we're in some way, you know, ethically or morally on the wrong side of the equation. And there's a heap of discussion around that in the business. And I think, you know, as a business gets under performance pressure, you can get those sort of wrong behaviors.
At the same time, I mean, I'm sure there's an awful lot of people in the audience kind of thinking, like, okay, someone like Tesco treats the suppliers really hard, but an awful lot of people in the audience may not have realized this. I didn't until I read Paul Mason, the Channel 4 Economics Editor's column on this, that, like, back in the day before supermarkets, the power all rested with the suppliers, and you did a completely different balance. So, I mean, what we're really just seeing here is, like, mean economics, aren't we?
Well, yeah, and I think, but I think, you know, the big suppliers and the big retailers, it's a good old dust up. Sometimes we win, sometimes we lose. I think that's okay. And I think the consumer has a right to expect us to negotiate hard on their behalf. And there are suppliers that frankly are bigger than us. You know, some of the big global guys can give us a good, you know, a good run. And that's okay. I think that's all fair. But I think we do need to watch it where the balance isn't even. Yeah. And we need to guard against that. And I think we're pretty proud, actually, of the strength of our relationships in Ireland, actually. You know, and I think we look at some of the reputational issues that the UK have, and that sort of does make us wince, you know, because I think we feel pretty proud of what we're doing here.
Okay. Let's turn to one issue that when we're supposed to be putting together notes of this and asking people for ideas and that, one thing came up again and again when you ask people about the future of food shopping and the future of supermarkets, and that was nutrition and health. Is this something you're noticing in your shops right now? Like, you know, is this something that you're noticing in Tesco and Fallon and Bird, that customers are coming in and they're like, you know, this is one of the issues. You mentioned earlier on, Rachel, that, like, I mean, prices, you're kind of in a sense of priorities. How important are customers placing, like, health and nutrition and food? And is this something which is going to grow in the next couple of years? Anyone there want to take the question?
Yeah, I mean, it's out there. It's one of the huge topics of the day. I think, you know, we've got a looming, or it's already here, massive obesity problem in Ireland. So it's something that has to be dealt with on every level. And I think consumers are really eager to be able to to be able to eat well and balance that with eating conveniently and all those kind of things. I think as retailers, we all have we play a role in education, and I think there's a very difficult, the consumer is quite baffled. I think right now there's so many mixed messages in terms of nutrition and what's good for you and what's not good for you and what you should be eating, what you shouldn't be eating, and red wine is good and coffee is bad. Oh no, coffee's good, red wine's good. It's all, you know, it's all kind of mixed up, and I think people, it is quite confusing for the consumer. So I think even on, like, government level, there's, even in terms of labeling and everything, there's a huge amount of work to be done, and that'll go all the way down the line. But it would be good to get into a situation where people can come into a shop, and the calorie thing looks like it's going to come in terms of prepared foods and restaurants and things, which, you know, I see as a good thing, because people need to know at this stage, and I think it's hard for people to know what they should be eating. But I think even in terms of the whole sort of traffic light thing in the UK didn't seem to work. I don't think it ended up confusing people even more. And then, you know, things could have a green light on them, but then there was a high salt content or a high sugar content. Lots of people who aren't celiac think they should be eating gluten-free things, which they shouldn't, because there's usually much more sugar in them. So it's a very confusing time for consumers. But nutrition is definitely top of the agenda for a huge amount of the population, as it should be and as it needs to be. Yeah.
Just to pick up on one of Rachel's points, one of the things that we debate are debating is our role in this question of health. And we're one of the bigger providers of food to Irish families, and therefore, what is our responsibility to the question of obesity? Should we or shouldn't we attempt to educate? We're here to serve, but are we also here to play a role? And it's a difficult one to strike a balance on. A good example would be in at the beginning of the year, we removed sweets from all of our checkouts. So the commercial team find that pretty tough, because there's a lot of sales wrapped up in that impulse purchase. And we did it because we felt that the time was right, and we felt that customers on balance would consider that good. But actually, it's not an easy debate to answer, because therefore we're starting to make choices sort of for our customers.
Yeah.
And where does that line sit? And that's an interesting and ongoing debate.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you see a column by Katie Sheridan in the Irish Times kind of saying that Tesco should bring in kind of healthy cooking schools for kids, is that kind of greeted with kind of jeers or cheers inside the Tesco HQ?
I would say cheers. I think there's heaps we can do. We did some stuff last summer with school children and with their parents, sort of bringing them through the stores and having some fun with discovering food and, you know, and enjoying different foods and allowing them to taste and sample. And so we are exploring how to do that, but to do it in the right way.
But that's the whole thing. I guess back to something Rachel was saying earlier on, you know, it strikes me that, like, I mean, when people go on about nutrition and health and, like, you know, say, you know, the obesity crisis on the way, you know, what the role of supermarkets is obviously key. But, like, you know, you said there earlier on, it's like, I mean, you don't want to be seeing, when you're taking away sweets from a checkout counter, you don't want to be seeing as kind of engaging in censorship of some kind. Yeah. And you're kind of pointing out that it's an all-over holistic thing. So, I mean, where is that demand going to come from consumers, do you reckon? Or is it going to be something that the government are going to have to kind of add to the list of million things they have to do?
I think the government has to lead on it. Because even, I mean, yes, as you know, as retailers, we have a role to play. But producers, like suppliers, have a massive role to play. You know, the likes of Pepsi Cola, the likes, you know, especially in prepared foods, the amount of hidden ingredients is astounding, and those are the things that are bad for you. People who are eating, you know, natural products, you know, cooking from scratch, usually do not have a health problem. It's people who are eating pre-prepared foods. So I think it has to come from government level, and there's just so much to be done on it that it has to come from the very basics and go all the way through. And then I think as retailers, like, we will pick up on that, because those products may not be available, or they may be packaged in such a way that it'll be very clear on the badness in them.
I do think there's a lot that retailers can be doing themselves. I mean, healthy food is where we came in. The co-op was set up by the founder members because you couldn't get Whole Foods in Ireland. And, you know, 30 years ago, that was the case. Nowadays, you walk into any supermarket, there's a whole range of organic, whole food, brown rice is ubiquitous. So we need to up our game. And what we're doing, we're working with people to educate them about the products. So, you know, you can have cookery demonstrations free or for a low price and say, okay, what do you do with chickpeas? How can you use them? How can you use quinoa? What sort of recipes can you put this food into? And the staff are engaging with that as well, because the staff get asked the questions on the tills. Mm. And if they can come up with the answers and say, oh, you do this with it, or you can do this, then that's educating the consumer, makes the consumer a more loyal member. They keep coming back. And they raise their own knowledge of what's on the shelves, rather than trying to do it by trial and error.
Mm. One thing you mentioned earlier on, mentioned that, like with Henry, was kind of like diversification. And, like, I mean, the fact that, like, you know, all of you actually, I think with the exception of Norman, all your shops are involved in kind of like more than just selling groceries. It sounded like, say, with Donnybrook Fair, Joe, I mean, you know, away from the kind of groceries, how important is the cafe element? How important is that restaurant element to the bottom line? Does it bring in size of the revenue? Is the revenue kind of like, I suppose, comparable to what you're doing in terms of groceries?
Wouldn't bring in the same revenue, or you know, I mean, our main line is retailing, is part of our business, but I suppose it makes brand awareness for us. And we run a cookery school now. We run it as a separate entity within the business at the moment, but it's something that's coming up. We'll use it more and more for training. We do a lot of school different schools. They come in and do week courses within the school, and I'll be teaching them how to use, you know, good healthy ingredients. So there's a lot of that going on at the moment, and we run competitions then at the end of between the schools for that. So there's a lot of that training, but it's more and more, I think, what's going into the food is important. The food we make ourselves is very important, that we let the consumer know what's going into them.
Yeah.
And I think the new labelling laws, I think it's going to bring a lot more transparency for what's going into prepared foods. I think it's good.
Do you reckon as well, like me, Joe, that, like me, that the new labelling, that it's going to be like going to make things more onerous from a labour point of view, and make things more onerous from a management point of view?
Not really, to be honest with you, because once you're in the manufacturing end of it, you know, it's there. It's there to be done, and you have to label properly. So I think it's probably going to be harder for restaurants and cafes and that type of thing, I'd say.
Yeah.
Because changing menus on a regular basis, I'd say it's going to be difficult.
Yeah. Going back to Fallon and Burn, I mean, that, and that diversification, Rachel, I mean, how important has the kind of the restaurant and the cafe been to the store? In, like, I know in terms of brand awareness, obviously it's huge. People go there for weddings, people go there for the restaurants, kind of like acclaimed, you know, and the cafe is where people drop in and out for coffee. But in terms of revenue, I mean, is it doing pretty well?
Oh yeah, it's a huge part. We've full restaurant upstairs and a full production kitchen downstairs to service the food hall. So yeah, what we produce in house is a huge part of what we do, and it's very much part of the brand, because it's the food that we have chosen and that we recommend. You know, that's cooked in house. I mean, we'd be very careful with that food of what goes into it, but you know, we sell all kinds of other things as well. So I think on a
Yeah. Okay. Aside from kind of, I suppose, nutrition and health, the other issue which came up again and again beforehand was about provenance, you know, and where the food comes from. Like, this is like, I mean, let's start with you, Norman, because I mean, this is something obviously that plays a big part with the food co-op. Just like, I mean, is this another issue you're hearing again and again? And where does it sit in terms of priorities? I know I keep kind of harking back to this. You know, I suppose I'm trying to kind of prove a theory that price still trumps all. But like, I mean, let's talk about provenance. I mean, are you all of you as retailers find that provenance is something that customers are caring about more and more, and you reckon something they're going to care about more in the future as well?
Absolutely. Provenance has been important for us because we've have such a high reliance on organic produce. I think 95% of our lines are organic and the rest are there for particular reasons. But our last member survey, Irish came out as top over organic. Irish, organic is still high, but Irish provenance is now our top priority. So last year we placed an advert in the Farmers Journal saying we want to find organic small suppliers and we want to listen to what you can produce. And if we can find space for it on our shelves and our members want to buy it, then that could be the basis of a good relationship. Tofu is a Chinese specialty food. It's soybean curd. It used to be all imported. There's now tofu producers in Ireland and it flies off the shelves. So we're actively looking to change the market. Only 1% of Irish agriculture is organic and we need to change that. And if we can do that through our purchasing, then we'll do it.
What about like me in Tesco? Is it a case of like, are people worried about problems? Are they kind of bringing it up? Are they more interested in having the non-knobbly and non-ugly vegetables in the rack?
It's a really big topic for us. It's hugely important to customers. I think the recession has really focused the consumer's mind on not just the back to this value and quality, but also sort of socially doing the right thing and supporting our own. So provenance has become a very big topic for us. And it's one that we wrestle with because perceptionally Tesco is, and even our regular customers would think that perhaps our meat comes from the UK or our produce comes from the UK because of the relationship, with perhaps the mothership. But in fact, 100% of our meat comes from Ireland, and we're very proud of that, and it has done for a number of years. And we've gone to the extent of having an independent economic study by a group called Indicom, which is a very, very credible group, to really establish the fact that we really are, as committed or more so to Irish food than any other retailer. And there's a lovely stat in there that they've confirmed with the world's biggest buyer of Irish food. And when I say that to consumers, they literally cannot believe it because they presume it's Musgraves or they presume it's, So it's a very, it's important for me to be able to sort of say, you can believe that we are committed to this agenda. I think there is a different attribute beyond Irish, though. I think there is and back to this trends point, small batch and local. So if Irish is important, but then almost within that, really demonstrating support for and growth of local foods is again a particular issue for us because we're seen as big and homogenous. Therefore, it's important that we demonstrate that we really are committed to, local being within county or within province.
Okay, so how does that manifest itself then? I mean, was that part of the recent initiative you announced with Borbia as well?
Yeah, so we've been doing it 4 years. And it's a partnership with Bord Beer to support small Irish brands. And I think one of the things with Tesco, I think we can be quite an intimidating organisation for a small brand to navigate, to work out how to take their product, through all the necessary steps to get onto the shelf. So by working with Bord Beer, we now have 70 Irish brands as part of the sort of Bord Beer program, which we call Taste Bud. And what's very exciting within that for us, and I think the sort of uniqueness, is that brands like Ballymaloe Relish, we're now exporting to the UK and international Tesco because of that partnership. And I think that gives a sort of source of pride for the people working in Tesco in Ireland that we can facilitate that. So it's exciting times.
Yeah. Last question on provenance. I mean, is it something you're noticing, Rachel? I would imagine that some of the Fallon Byrne customers are quite outspoken and quite and they wouldn't be shy in giving their opinion. Is this something that are they coming up and kind of saying well, why is this garlic being flown all the way from China? We could get it in Ireland. Is that an issue that's coming up? And is it something again that you're expecting to see more of in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's especially sort of. After the recession, there was a near obsession with buying local and buying Irish. And, products like rapeseed oil, for instance, everyone wanted rapeseed oil because it was Irish. And, nobody wanted olive oil anymore. And if they did, they were like, well, do you not have an Irish one? Like, no, you can only get rapeseed oil. You have to change. Not everything can be produced here. So I think that it has become hugely important to people. On a kind of local level, but even on an international level as well, people are, I suppose our customers especially, are extremely well-travelled. People really care where something is from. They want to know where in Sicily it's from, who exactly made it? You know, why are they maturing it for longer than the people that make it in Spain or whatever it is? So it's people are they just want to know more, which is fantastic, because it's a you know, food is a subject for people. It's not just about something to eat. It's the whole culture around it that people really want more information on. And yeah, I think that can only grow. And I suppose that is, you know, in the States now. Well, obviously, it started in Italy, but Eataly is a huge concept store in New York, and their whole thing is shopping and educating, and it's all based around Italian products. But it's that whole vibe of people's just desire to know more and to want to understand exactly the provenance of whatever it is they're having.
We've mentioned a couple of different, I suppose, like trend drivers for the future. I mean, nutrition, health. You're talking there, Rachel, about like, I mean, travel, provenance, price again. Like, I mean, are there any other trends the four of you as retailers can see coming down the line? What will be the other kind of like, I mean, trends that will dictate how people eat in the future? Like, I mean, like besides the ones we've mentioned, what have we left out?
I think technology is huge. Because I think, and it's this whole data capturing. It's understanding what people want and making sure it's there when they want it. And that's a whole world that's opening up. And I think that's going to change everything massively. I was reading something the other day about on a loyalty thing. It was this interview with somebody in the States, but they were saying, I'd like to be rewarded for, I mean, it's kind of like loyalty gone mad, but I'd like to be rewarded for making a healthy choice. So it's like marrying the two. Yeah. So instead of going for the apple pie, going for the fresh apples and like getting extra bonus points because of that. So, you know, I think there's a whole world of interesting things going on in technology.
Jeez, that strikes me as a kind of, I'm going to say something here, I'm going to get lynched. That kind of strikes me as almost like millennial sense of entitlement there. I'm going to get lynched, I can tell by the reaction. what are trends can you see coming down the line, Norman and Joe, like in terms of like, I mean, things which are going to dictate changes in how people shop for food in the future?
Well, I hate to rain on my colleague's parade here, but I think ownership is going to be increasingly important. The cooperative movement worldwide is growing. In the UK, where we've got better figures on the movement, during the recession, GDP went down by about 6%, but the GDP of the cooperative movement, the turnover of the cooperative movement, rose by 20% because, you know, people were turning to trust the banks, big business. You know, cooperative financial services are winning market share from the banks because they've got a lack of trust. And I think that's going to be very important, owning and controlling the process from fork to plate, from sort of soil to plate, is going to be increasingly important.
Okay, that's very good. The technology ownership. Do you want to add anything to that list, Joe?
Well, I suppose we're talking about producers, smaller producers, just bringing those into your retail environment. They become more partners in your business than just suppliers. And I think because there's an awful lot of knowledge out there in the field, and it's getting those producers in to talk to your customer and work with your business is one of the things that we feel it's very useful for us.
Okay, producers, ownership, and technology. One has that list, Henry?
Yeah, a few things spring to mind. I think I'd echo the points from the guys, perhaps not ownership, but...
I'm sure Dave Lewis has something to say about if you did.
Yeah. I think there's a few things spring to mind. I think one of the conversations we're having in Tesco is the older consumer. You know, it fascinates us that 35% of grocery sales are with consumers over 65. And we haven't been very good at thinking about that cohort. And I'm not sure a lot of our supplier brands who come and talk to us have been very good at thinking about that cohort. And when we've done consumer groups with them, they're a fascinating bunch because they're, you know, highly independent, typically independently wealthy. You know, the mortgage is paid, the children are gone, they traveled, they're knowledgeable, they're hugely active. They kind of see old people as sort of post 80, you know, it's not them. And so that's a group that I think is, and I think in Irish society over the next 10, 20 years, it's going to become an increasingly bigger part. So that's something that we are reflecting on. I think from a marketing mix point of view, and I guess back to the technology point, I think content, so sort of from where we are today, which is a lot of push marketing, sort of TV, radio, etc., I think there's a real sea change happening towards pull, you know, content-driven, draw people towards you through great content, allow them to choose to opt in or not. And I think that's very exciting / challenging. So I think there's a couple of things there that are giving us food for thought.
Okay, great. Upon to end, of course. Excellent. We're going to take a break for about 10, 15 minutes and we'll come back for some questions from the audience. But right now, could you give a round of applause, please, to the four panellists? Hi, folks. Welcome back to Banter here at the Twisted Pepper. So it's time for some questions for you. So we have a microphone. And Garrett, our amazing Salma, will get you a microphone. So put your hand up and Garrett will see you. Starting with the man in the red jacket at the very back.
Hi. Thanks very much to all the panellists. I have a question in particular for the representatives from Tesco and Donnybrook Fair. And it's to do with packaging. I find it really upsetting and depressing how much packaging comes when I purchase stuff in your outlets, especially regarding fresh foods with Tesco. And Joe, with your meals, there's a lot of that big black tray thing you've got going on. And I just love to know why so much packaging and why does it have to be plastic and what are you going to do to reduce it?
In the future.
In the future.
Thank you very much. Just make sure all the questions are on point. Joe.
It's a challenge, without question. I suppose there's one thing, it's all biodegradable, the packaging we use. And I suppose it's, there again, the product that's in them, in some cases, it's for microwavable or ovenable, and it is a balance. We are looking at it all the time. We've tried, lesser type of packaging, and it won't hold the food quality, and that is a challenge for us, without question. Don't have the answers at the moment. We're still trying to find them all.
Tesco?
Yeah, it's a really live debate in our business. And it's a conundrum, if I can be honest with you, because if I take fruit and veg as a good example, I love it when we have loose fruit and veg. I think it really allows the consumer to choose their individual products. I think it improves, I know it improves quality perception. The contradiction, though, is actually it damages the food. The food itself, the more it is touched, the more it is handled, the worse the quality scores become. And actually, when we have increased the amount of loose food, what the consumers don't actually in volume buy into it, and so we get a lot more waste. So you get a situation where visually it looks fabulous, but commercially it doesn't sell, and you get more waste. And so it's finding the right balance and allowing consumers to guide us a little bit on that. Where do they want to go? Interestingly, I take your point on cellophane in vegetables and fruit. It looks horrendous. So we are exploring all sorts of ways to, you know, use different types of packaging that allows the consumer to touch and smell and hold, but does the job of protecting the product in the right way. So it's a really good question, and it's a really live debate for us.
So 5 years from now, will you still have that packaging, do you think?
Yeah, we'll still have packaging, because I think about, if I take just vegetables, an example, about 90% of our vegetables are sold in some form of packaging, even when we've pushed the amount of loose veg up. So I think there'll always be packaging. I think we can do a lot better than the sort of cellophane that you see too much of now.
Okay, next question. Just put your hand up and get the microphone to you. Don't be shy. Yep, woman here in the front row. We'll get the microphone up to you now.
How are you doing?
Hi, everyone. I had a notebook here, and I realized I had 9 questions, so I'm trying to be selective. I'm only going to ask one. But it's just such a thoughtful debate. I moved back to Ireland from having lived in Denmark for 3 years ago and had largely been exposed to organic veg in the supermarkets there. And one of the things I did was I Googled about organic veg in my local area, which is Skerries. So I found a local group there that is called Community Harvest, the Community Harvest Group, and we partner with, or basically we're 40 families that eat organic veg from a local farmer. Now that operates not for the full year, so there's a few months in the year where I don't eat the organic veg, and I notice such a difference in terms of how I feel and just, you know, in terms of my family. So one of my main question is picking up on a point that was made earlier about rewarding people for healthy choices. And I want to twist that a little bit further and ask specifically to Tesco again, I'm sorry to say this, but could you reward more Irish farmers to produce organically if you are the largest producer of or buyer of Irish food? And I think that would be huge potential for the future. I do shop in Tesco. I've also switched more so to Lidl because of the quality of the fruit and veg that I get, and also the choices that I can make to have more organic veg in the months where I can't get it from Paddy the farmer. But I think that would be a huge way for you as a business and other businesses of that scale to actually up the organic offerings.
Back to Moral Compass again.
Yes, I think it's a really good challenge for us. Could we incentivize or work with Irish producers to produce more organic? I think that the challenge, if I'm perfectly candid, is we're not seeing, we have a lot of organic produce in our stores, and we're not seeing a massive growth in organic, interestingly. I mean, I know that's not your experience, and I think we do tend to, being a commercial organization, we look for, if it's growing, therefore we'll do more of it. If it's not, therefore we'll hold, and if it's selling less, then we'll hold it back. And organic is not one of those. Interestingly, in the whole context of sort of health and sustainability and packaging, and there's a huge amount of growth in lots of healthier options, but organic is not one that right now we're seeing a lot of growth in, which is interesting. I think if we went back 5 years, it was growing an awful lot faster than it is now. We see a lot of consumers demanding free range, grass fed, but it's almost as though there's skepticism a little bit about the idea of organic, actually. So it's a little bit, it's funny, it's kind of nuanced a little bit.
Can I come back on that point? I think you could incentivize people through price, because when I look at the offerings for organic, it is a price difference, yeah, as well. And that is for sure in Ireland. That's why people have got into recycling in their bins, because it's cheaper to, put stuff in the green bin. Yeah.
Yes, we could. And then it comes back to choices. Is it the right thing for us to incentivize? Because there's no question that the organic process is more expensive, the input costs are more, that the process is therefore it's in a way right that it should be more expensive, because the whole process does cost more. And I think, I mean, I can't give you the answer, because I don't have it on what we're going to do about organic. But I think it's a good challenge, and it's thought-provoking for me.
Okay, next question. There's someone here, and there's someone over here as well. Get you first of all.
Hello. I think it was a really cool debate, and I have a interesting question. Not really. I'm just thinking about sort of, you're talking about incentivizing people to buy healthy food. Do you think there's a question sometimes around sort of manipulation of environments? So in my local SuperValue, they've recently refurbished the interior design so that when you enter the store, you're immediately going into the fruit and veg section. And I wouldn't quite call it manipulation, but it's incentivizing people to buy healthier food rather than the central aisles being filled with sweets and stuff. So in all of your stores, really, have you thought about that sort of manipulating environment?
That's a good question, because it goes back to that idea about shopping in supermarkets where you stick to the outer rim and don't go into the middle aisle. I was just thinking about all your supermarkets. Definitely Fallon Byrne, I know when you go in the door, the vegetables are facing you. I mean, that idea of let's call it smart supermarket design, is that another trend we should talk about, Norman?
Well, we do the opposite, actually, because if you walk into the food court, you pass the dry goods section, then you have to get the fresh vegetables right down at the back in the market area. So we do the opposite.
But it's a bit like IKEA, then.
Yeah, it doesn't fall apart when you take it home, though.
Very good. What about the idea, Joe and Rachel, of supermarket design, and the idea, as the questioner was kind of saying, about manipulation in a nice way?
You lay out your store to suit the trend of shopping, and I suppose it so happens fruit and veg is probably one of the first things you would meet. Your fresh breads, it's all your appetizers lead your customer into your store. I suppose you put the milk down the back of the store because everyone's milk. So I mean, it's all tried and tested, and to be honest, I suppose a lot of us copy it more so than spend a lot of time coming up with something a wee bit different. I think
From my perspective, it's a great question, and it's an absolutely fascinating area. It's the thing I probably enjoy most, looking at how do we evolve the design and how do we create a better experience for consumers. And there's no question, the more, when you put something at the front of the store, it sells more. And there's sort of a little quote in the business, not everything can be at the front. Every category team wants to get their products at the front just because the deeper into the store, the lower the footfall. But from our point of view, we think it is exactly the right thing to lead in with fresh food. So all of our latest designs would do that. Not really in the spirit of manipulation, because it sounds sort of cynical, but because that's what consumers enjoy. It's the thing they want to buy first.
Cool. Okay. And there's a question over here on this side. Yeah, there's a woman over here. Would you have a microphone over to you? She's just back about 2 rows there, please. How you doing?
Hi. I was just wondering how you guys handle your food waste, because inevitably, massive supermarkets from your massive stores to your extra format, and then of course then to the cafes and the restaurants. How you deal with food waste, both in terms of what you actually sell and then what you cook and sell in restaurants, how you're managing that and how that has changed over the past few years and how you expect it to change as well, I suppose.
I think it's obviously a huge issue and something that we're constantly trying to improve. I suppose our formula is quite good in one respect because we have production kitchens in-house. So in terms of fruit and veg, we would try and move things through before they go off. So you can make soup out of a carrot that is going to be off in a couple of days' time that you won't be able to sell. We also donate to a soup kitchen a lot of fruit and veg every day, but we still have waste. And we're constantly trying to improve that. So I think everyone would agree it's a factor that we have to try and do better. And
is there any way of actually reducing it, the numbers then? I mean, or is it a case of if you try and reduce it, what happens then is you don't
have to stop. Our accountants would love to reduce it. You know, I mean, we're always trying to reduce it. I think that's that step one is, you know, order better. So that you don't have it, but then if you do have it, is to let it go. You know, make sure it goes somewhere that doesn't end up in the bin, because that's a tragedy for food that could be eaten by somebody else or used in some other way.
Yeah, there's a tension between wanting the store to be fully available and abundant right to the end of the day, and then the challenge of food waste. We struck on an idea last year, working with two social entrepreneurs. And it's an organization that's called Food Cloud, and it's absolutely fabulous because it's one of those really simple ideas that just clicks. And so just to explain it very briefly, the store manager, as he gets to 5 o'clock, and some of our stores may stay open to 9, 10, etc., he can judge what his run rate is going to be. And so at 5 o'clock, he'll post on the app the quantity of food that he doesn't anticipate to sell by the end of the day. And then local charities who also have the app, are able to sort of put the hand up, you know, digitally and say, we'll take that. And therefore they can take in-date product towards the end of the day and then serve it to, you know, their clients and therefore give them a hot meal, etc. And it works beautifully because it manages a significant issue on food waste for us, and it serves the community need at the same time. So it's one of those lovely win-wins where technology plays a really neat role. And I think we hit our 500,000th meal relatively recently. So that's one of those nice things that I can tell the 15,000 colleagues, and it's a real source of pride to say, do you know what, we're doing our little bit. So that's a nice example of technology working.
Yeah, that's the third time I've heard about Food Cloud in the last week. So they're obviously doing a lot of good things as well. Great. Next question. Person over here. Just.
My question's for Mr. Wright. So I think a lot of consumers have realized that the way we shop for food today is bad for your health, it's bad for the environment, and bad for the local economy. It's even bad psychologically. It makes you overweight. Producers use lots of pesticides. It takes away local jobs. And it's an impersonal way to shop, using robots and the internet and what have you. Just to talk about a few of the well-known reasons. Now, if someone realizes that, it's very easy for the big companies to turn around with their massive marketing budgets and say, well, actually, we've got these wonderful, lovely win-win solutions for benefiting the community using technology. If someone overcomes that hurdle and then goes to, say, the co-op, they then will find that the products are more expensive and it's difficult to shop there. So I'd like to know, having got through the marketing guff, having gone through your doors and seen the prices, why should you stay there?
I think the first point is that sort of you look at the prices, that's not what you actually pay. Because if you remember, you get 5% discount. If you volunteer and help stack the shelves or sort of do the welcome desk to allow members to join or do any of the other voluntary activities around the co-op, then you get 15%. If you buy in bulk, you can get 18% for more than €50 purchase and 22% for more than €100 purchase. So the actual headline price is not what you pay. And we did a price survey because members were complaining about the prices. So we did a price survey. We went around and we looked at like-for-like products around competitor stores. And out of 40 products we tested, we were level or cheaper on 37 out of 40. And when you took into account the 5% discount, we were level or cheaper on 39 out of 40. So what we need to do is perhaps become a bit more sophisticated, because competitors will use buy one, get one free. They will use promotions on single lines. We don't do any of that, sort of those more sophisticated marketing techniques. You know, we have a single markup right across the board. So, you know, maybe we do need to get a bit more sophisticated and create the impression that our prices aren't as expensive as people think. Because when we've done the comparison, you know, we are cheaper or equal to most of our competitors.
So beyond price, though, Norman, what, like as the question is asking, what else is there to kind of like me keep someone there? Is it the fact that they're one of 1,800 people? Is it kind of like me a vibe where it's a local community? I mean, what are the selling points as far as you're concerned to kind of persuade your man here who's going into the shop and looking at the price of courgettes and kind of go, I can get that cheaper in Lidl or Fallon and Burnie?
It's the whole package. The question earlier on packaging. You know, that came out in our member survey, third or fourth, if I recall, out of the priorities. And we do work hard on getting environmentally sound packaging. We try and get compostable packaging wherever we can. If we can't get compostable, it needs to be biodegradable. If it's not compostable or biodegradable, then we'll be very reluctant to stock your product. So if you're a producer and you come up and you say, oh, this is a plastic package and three layers of packaging, and say, sorry, no, that doesn't fit in with what we're about. And on the food waste, very little of it is food wasted, because our producer members are small holders, small producers. They take their stock home with them at the end of the day. If things are definitely unsaleable, then it goes to compost. We've worked with a local night shelter. We've taken a bootload of food round to the night shelter on a Saturday evening after the main market. So our food waste in the whole building, the whole co-op, is probably less than a household's brown bin a week. So we're very sound on that. And I think it's the whole package of what you're buying into. You know, the co-op isn't a retailer. We're almost a way of life. And I think if you want to share that way of life and you want to share with our objectives, then yes, you can join. You can be part of it. It can help determine our policies. You're against genetically modified organisms? Yep. Turn up to the general meeting and vote in favour with the rest of the members, and we won't touch genetically modified foods. All those things are part of what we come to as a community and what we stand for as a community. So yes, I mean, we're much more than a retailer.
Cool. Okay. Got time for one last question. Over here. Is that Ella?
Yeah.
Hi, Ella. How are you?
I just wanted to ask the gentleman from Tesco about the recent accounting scandal related to payments from suppliers and why you think that happened and the reflection in terms of the viability of Tesco as a model. It was quite extraordinary, along with obviously the $6 billion loss that you experienced.
Why do I think it happened?
What do you think it says about your model?
I think it says that we allowed some practices that weren't appropriate, and I think we've put into the public domain sort of where we are with that. And I think for us, it's a really important and, you know, significant learning. And therefore, what we've done since then is a heap of training with all of our buying teams on what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. And recognizing that behaviors tend to follow from, you know, pressure can create behaviors, and therefore readjusting our expectations accordingly, and then making sure the training and all of those things are in place. And I think, you know, the issue with the accounting, or the issue perhaps a couple of years ago with Horseburger, these things are really tough to bear for an organization like us. They're hard, they hurt, but what we do then is respond and learn and improve. So, and I think ultimately, you know, that it'll be a force for good.
Because there are commentators who would say that you're in terminal decline, but actually it's just not a model that's viable anymore, and the accounting scandal shows that.
Yeah, I don't think we're in terminal decline. I think we've had a very tough time, and I think we've learned a lot through going through a very tough time, and nowhere more so than Ireland. We've had a very tough 2 or 3 years, and I think it's the measure of an organisation. Of course, we haven't got a right to win. It's a very competitive market, and we have to respond, and we have to improve, and we have to raise our game, and I think we are. So, I don't know. Terminal decline, we'll see, but I don't think so.
Okay, we're back in 5 years to test out that one, terminal decline. Please give a warm round of applause and thanks to Rachel, to Norman, to Joe, and to Himmel. Thank you all very much for coming out tonight. It's great to see you. Great to see such an interest in this topic. Check thisisbanter.com for more information on what we're up to in the next couple of weeks. We'll see you all again real soon, and safe home. Thank you. Thanks a million to Henry, Rachel, Joe and Norman for taking part in Banter. This Banter podcast was recorded by Garrett Hines and produced by series producer, the mighty Tanya White. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate us and spread the word. Tell your friends about us, recommend us on your favourite social media network, leave a review or a rating on the iTunes store, and don't forget to subscribe. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news of our website Banter, and we'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.